Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're discussing housing in the interwar years. Housing often, to many people, sounds rather a dull topic, but at the level of individuals, it's crucial, and at the level of communities, it's crucial. And I was talking about how the modern semi, indeed the kind of house I grew up in, was built, financed and developed. I also want to make it clear, of course, that it wasn't only semis in the interwar period. There was also council housing, which was increasingly important for many as an alternative that most people, in fact, couldn't afford at that juncture because the private rental market declined. And in fact, this is an important point. A lot of British history is a matter in the 20th century is a matter of the relationship between the ownership, or in a sense, borrowing for ownership, debt, and the two types of rental property, council and private. And those are often closely and more closely linked to people's political identities and social aspirations than they will frequently admit to. The reason why the private rental market had declined was because private landlordship had become less profitable, and there was therefore less private investment in the building of new properties for rent, which is something the Labour government at the present moment need to watch if it makes private landowning difficult. I mean, it'll hit the existing private landowners, but the key thing is it's not going to make it very attractive for others to finance new construction. Council housing was an aspect of an increasingly mixed welfare provision in the interwar years, one with old and new local and national characteristics. And it's worth bearing in mind that much of the private rental market was substandard housing, some of it was slum housing. And as a result of that, I think it's fair to say that many people continued to face harsh conditions in deprived areas. But there was also private renting in the shape of new urban building and conversions, often for single people. For example, H.C. Bailey, in his short story, The Broken Toad of 1934, referred to the conversion of houses by the forces of progress into modern ugliness as blocks of flats offering modern comfort to those who do without babies. Well, that's obviously an emotive approach, but there was certainly private money going into building, not just for families, but in particularly for single people. Meanwhile, separate to the new construction, there were also what one might call left-behind towns, towns that were often frequently bypassed market centres. And you can see that both in fact and fiction. For example, if you look at Agatha Christie, who was particularly familiar with Devon, England's third largest county after Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, and the one with many bypassed market centres, she referred in her novel Dumb Witness of 1937, she wrote, quote, "There is the little town of Market Basing, originally on the main road, a modern bypass now left it some 3 miles to the north of the main stream of traffic. And in consequence, it had kept an air of old-fashioned dignity and quietude about it. Its once wide street and ample market square seemed to say, I was a place of importance once, and to any person of sense and breeding, I am still the same. Let this modern speeding world dash along their new-fangled road. I was built to endure in a day when solidarity and beauty went hand in hand." Obviously, those who are literary will be familiar with the parallel, in a way, in Charles Dickens' Edwin Drood, with the description of the fictional Cloisterham, which is based on Rochester in Kent, which, as it were, had been bypassed by the train. In The Moving Finger of 1943, Christie again wrote about a fictional town, quote, "Somewhere in 1700 and something, the tide of progress swept Limpstock into a backwater. The castle crumbled. Neither railways nor main roads came near Limpstock. It turned into a little provincial market town, unimportant and forgotten, with a sweep of moorland rising behind it and placid farms and fields ringing it round. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that all too often, and I hope I haven't done this too much, the account of urban history misrepresents the experience of many because it looks only at the major towns and the most and those developing fastest. And then, of course, many don't live in those kind of centres. And that's one of the reasons why people often describing the urban experience get it wrong, not least its politics. At the same time, alongside towns not doing well, rivalry between more successful towns continued and developed. Nearby towns, indeed, were frequently rivals, as well as often having elements of economic cooperation. So you can see that with Manchester and Liverpool, or Leeds and Sheffield. Or, for example, take railways. Finished in 1914, Hull's King George V dock competed with the Great Central Railway's Immingham dock on the other side of the Humber, finished 2 years earlier. And each of them were linked to particular hinterlands, producing it specifically coal, and profited accordingly. Some towns were hit very hard in the 30s. During the slump of that decade, unemployment in Sunderland rose to 75% of shipbuilders and half of the working population, and was associated with hardship and higher rates of ill health. Jarrow on the Tyne, another shipbuilding town, also had unemployment levels of over 70%, and its MP, Ellen Wilkinson, helped organise the Jarrow March to draw attention to this and wrote The Town That Was Murdered, which was published in 1939. But I think it's worth bearing in mind before one just focuses on this, and just focuses on the according novels and paintings and political memorialization at the present moment. It's worth bearing in mind that in depressed areas, more generally across the north, but including towns such as Sunderland, there was still, for the many in work, good housing, a higher quality of life than hitherto, and more consumer choice. Moreover, compared to serious problems in shipbuilding towns and those on or near coal fields, there was growth and dynamism in some northern areas, for example, Manchester and Liverpool, with urban planning directed to that end. At the same time, people moved from many northern towns to areas of greater economic opportunity, mostly in the Midlands, Birmingham, for example, and Coventry, and the southeast. Although it's also worth bearing in mind that there was much poverty in these areas, which indeed remains the case. I get rather bored listening. I used to live in Newcastle for 16 years, and people endlessly went on about how the South was so much more prosperous. Well, if they visited places like Paignton in Devon, or Chatham and the Medway more generally in Kent, they might have a slightly different viewpoint. Indeed, the poverty of many people was captured in Christie's ABC murders in 1934, with the first murder, that in Andover, of, quote, an old woman who kept a little tobacco shop, a couple of old worn blankets on the bed, a little stock of well-darned underwear in a drawer, cookery recipes in another, a paper-backed novel entitled The Green Oasis, a pair of new stockings, pathetic in their cheap shininess, a couple of china ornaments, a Dresden shepherd, much broken, and a blue and yellow spotted dog, a black raincoat and a woolly jumper hanging on pegs. Such were the worldly possessions of the late Alice Asher. And I think it's fair to say that many were in that condition, but of course it always been in that condition. And of course, what's interesting in that account, and of course what Poirot is to spot at the stockings, the stockings, of course, brought round by a central figure in that story, but of course part of a cash economy, consumerism. Alongside movement between and within urban areas, there was also movement from country to towns. W.H. Auden, the poet, was biting about social change in his The Dog Beneath the Skin of 1935. writing of migration from countryside to towns. He wrote as follows: "Their children have entered the service of the suburban areas. They have become typist mannequins and factory operatives." Well, actually, as factory operatives, the children of ploughmen generally had a better life, and as typists, which was not a particularly well-paid job, they would have had more social freedom than many young women living in rural areas. Moreover, the countryside benefited from towns. There was agricultural production, for which imports were no substitute, notably with milk, market gardening and fruit. And rural, especially coastal areas, could benefit from tourism. And the point about milk is significant. I mean, people drank a lot of milk in that period. And indeed, this is one of the, and you know, a lot of southern England, Midland England, Vale of York had very extensive pasture down to cattle. And of course, during World War II, with the German blockade and the difficulty of importing grain, some of that pasture and some of the sheep pasture was dug up accordingly. Moreover, rural, especially coastal areas, could benefit from urban tourism, which of course had developed in particular in the late 19th century with rail. Tourism grew, for example, in Cornwall in the 1930s, bringing prosperity to Bude and Newquay. And the 1930s sees the development of Butlin's holiday camps as at Minehead on the Somerset coast. Across the country, for both urban and rural, working class diets showed more energy provision and nutrient content for households headed by those in work by about 20% in energy. Children benefited from school meals and milk, neither of which had been present a century earlier. Whatever their degree of prosperity, towns were the centres of an electricity revolution. Electricity seen, as indeed it was, as clean and convenient and made available by the new national grid. The infrastructure achievement of the national grid makes so much of modern Britain so disappointing. Power, heat and light in towns were increasingly dependent on electricity, as was refrigeration. In his novel Invisible Weapons of 1938, John Rode wrote of, quote, "all the latest gadgets, tiled bathroom, latest type of gas cooker, electric refrigerator, coke boiler for constant hot water, a labour-saving house." Novels are important as sources because they capture what was in many senses normative. And of course, if you get it wrong and write something that's fantastical, then it can only be seen as fantastical. Nobody would see Harry Potter as a description of modern education. By 1938, 65.4% of homes were wired for electricity, and electric cookers, irons, fridges, water heaters, and vacuum cleaners were plentiful. And they contributed to a standard of living also seen for many, clearly not all, but for many, with bathrooms, with reasonably sized gardens, and with the provision of telephones. Moreover, these facilities provided the background to a more private and domestic pattern of family life. More residences were single family. Town life proportionately was less on the street and more in the home than in the 19th century, and there was a major transformation in urban life, although one that clearly very much varied by social group. Towns were also a centre of political agitation in England, though not the only sphere, as mining areas, most of which, of course, were rural, urban rural, if you like, were also important. Moreover, the pattern of behaviour varied greatly. 1919, a police strike that gained significant support in Liverpool led to looting and the restoration of order by troops. But most towns in England didn't see comparable problems. The only major British town that did was Glasgow. Support for the general strike in 1926 was strong in London, in Birmingham, Liverpool, Hull, Norwich and Plymouth, but far weaker in Portsmouth and Southampton, and mixed in Bristol and Manchester. Moreover, in 1935, the Conservative dominated national government, on 53.3% of the vote, Labour gained 37.9%, won 429 seats, including all those from industrial towns such as Blackburn, Bolton, Derby, Leicester, Newcastle, Oldham, Plymouth, Salford and Sunderland. and most of urban England indeed supported the national government. So I think one's got to be very cautious about this idea that the 1930s was a period of low living standards, appalling depression, a kind of working class just waiting for the Labour government to come through to majority status in 1945. That was scarcely, in fact, an account that works. And of course, more generally, leaving aside the empirical problem, actually, i.e. the facts, it also, you know, one needs to be aware of the problems with the notion of the zeitgeist, the so-called spirit of the age. People tend to identify a zeitgeist that supports their interpretation, and then they give it, they reify it and turn it into something that, as it were, dictates the way in which things should go. It's not like that. People are much more varied. There's much more complexity. And that was true of the 30s, as indeed it is of the 2020s. Now, politics of a very different type was demonstrated in the 1940s with the outbreak of World War II for Britain in 1939. And of course, there was German air attack from 1940 and missile attack from 1944. If you go around Britain, the remains of old Coventry Cathedral are a continuing testimony to the devastation of the war. And indeed, you can see war damage and its impact in English town after English town. The street I live in, sort of three of the 12 houses were destroyed, and more generally and at a greater scale, much of Exeter was devastated. Across Britain as a whole, much of the housing stock was destroyed or damaged. But there were also marked variations between and within cities, reflecting both German targeting and operational vagaries, but not least because the bombs and rockets were dumb munitions and not the smart, so-called smart guided ones of the present day. There were particularly strong attacks on the docks, and therefore the dock cities, through which food was imported and where the Navy could operate, notably Liverpool, London, Plymouth, Southampton and Weymouth, as well as on industrial centres, for example, Coventry and Manchester. Opportunity also encouraged attacks on settlements on or close to the south coast, such as Plymouth, Southampton and Exeter. And even when there was general Allied air superiority, there was still tip-and-run attacks on south coast towns, German planes coming over, you know, bombing hospitals, as in Torquay, or machine gunning civilians on the front by the sea. Many people were killed. For example, the week of the 21st of April 1941 alone, 590 Plymouth civilians were killed and 1,144 injured. Novels very much captured much of what was the experience. So in E.C.R. Lorak's novel Checkmate to Murder of 1944, wartime London has food shortages, blackout, gloom, irritation, and an officious and somewhat sinister special constable trying to buy up bomb-damaged property. For Christie, it was the bombing that's to the fore, and that leaves a lasting impression of a society under assault, as in her post-war novel After the Funeral, 1953. Quote, a brick or something hit her as she was walking down Tottenham Court Road. It was during flybomb, that's V1 rocket, rockets, 1944-5 time, collapsed in a train to Liverpool 12 hours later. In John Brandon's effective novel, A Scream in Soho of 1940, German spies readily go about their murderous business in London. In fact, you were more likely to be killed by the effects of trying to walk around in the dark during the blackout. But nevertheless, it was not, you know, it was not free of many, many, many dangers, the wartime urban experience. The war also brought the greatest movement of the urban population hitherto, for the evacuation of children and others was accompanied by the removal of many men through conscription and through the movement of jobs and workers to war work. Wartime surveys on, for example, the evacuation of suggested that existing health and welfare services were inadequate, contributing to the idea that social amelioration through state policy had to be expanded. Well, of course, that's what civil servants tended to argue, and that poor conditions in towns, for example, of sanitation, were the central problem. There was also the impact of wartime employment on, you know, wartime service on employment and wages, and money for an expansion of, in fact, it's rather ironic here, you know, wartime employment sort of also, I mean, I was thinking about this just earlier this morning, wartime employment also brought money into the cities because, soldiers on leave, or the fact you were running a really pretty full employment economy in contrast to the 30s meant there was much more money available for drink and in particular for going to the cinema, which remained very popular, including during the air raids. Social mores were greatly affected by the war. There was more freedom for women because far more were employed, while there was a general absence of partners, as well as different attitudes. In June 1943, the Mass Observation Survey, reporting on female behaviour in some pubs, found, quote, a free and easy atmosphere in which it was very easy and usual to pick up with a member of the opposite sex. Illegitimate births increased. Aside from changes resulting directly from the conflict, such as the presence of large numbers of the military, aspects of life as diverse as crime and religion, work and the arts, were all greatly affected by the war. Religious observance declined markedly. It's worth bearing in mind, though, that the varied effects of the war, which included the blackout, far more comprehensive during German air raids, needs to be, as it were, again counterpointed. Again, this was occurring to me this morning. London was less closed down than it was to be during the very different COVID pandemic of 2020 to 2022. I mean, people were still able to socialise together or to take shelter together. The extent to which the war led to a consensual society is unclear. There was certainly a language of inclusiveness and sharing and a stress on the home front, which made social distinctions seem unacceptable. But there was also resistance to government policy, not least with the insistent black market, which proved a way to evade rationing and extended the makeshift economy to much of society. Nevertheless, the overwhelming reality measured up to the public reputation. The population, including those in the towns who, after all, were the focus of air attack, displayed tremendous fortitude and individual and collective self-reliance and mutual assistance in the face of a sustained and deadly assault. Obviously, there were things that went wrong when there was the first terrible attack in the Southampton Blitz. The civil authorities proved unable to cope and some of them fled. But on the whole, there was tremendous fortitude, and more so, I suspect, that would be shown in a modern Britain, though let's hope we don't get the chance to find out. Wartime damage helped bring to fruition earlier discussion of planned urban reconstruction. But planners designing for the post-war often envisaged a rebuilding that was to break with the patterns of the past, providing instead a new future for a new society, as they put it. In practice, their achievements often failed to match up to the hopes raised, no surprise there. Men like Patrick Abercrombie for London and Plymouth and Thomas Sharp for Exeter felt they had been presented with a blank slate on which to build. And this was broadened because of the many historic buildings which were also demolished after the war, as in Exeter. This slate apparently offered an opportunity to realise their pre-war inclinations for slum removal and what was called improvement through modern progressive urban architecture, progress, of course, understood in their terms. In their view, it was not an option to rebuild cities as before, notably given the constraints posed by a shortage of resources and funds and a pressure for speed. Instead, they sought a rapid embrace of change. In this, Abercrombie and other planners tried to separate residential, commercial, and industrial areas into distinctive precincts. These measures were seen as likely to enhance efficiency and the quality of life, but in practice hit communities as well as damaging the workshop-based employment that had been so important in towns where industry and housing were closely linked. Moreover, the new town centres also proved of limited visual appeal. So Abercrombie's work to a degree appreciated the nature of community, but there was an excessive willingness by him and others to remould the street pattern for the sake of motorists. In Plymouth, there was a failure to assess the consequences of opening up the town for exposure to wind and wind-driven rain, and notably so in the shape of the prevailing Atlantic westerlies. One can put to one side, not that it's necessarily untrue, but I just simply haven't worked on the subject, the suggestions made by W.G. Hoskins, the noted scholar of English local history, who argued with specific reference to Exeter, that there had been collusion, if not corruption, involving local government, planners, and businesses. I don't know whether that's true, but it certainly seems very, very, very plausible. And I think it's also more widely the case. Now, aside from the war, of course, disruption was and change was also shown by and coming in as a result of a much more proactive, in its own eyes, state, with the Labour governments of 1945 to 1951 pushing through both attempts at regulation in the terms of green belts, but also new towns. They sought to replace suburbia, a sort of a mix which had had an organic quality as long as well as being planned and obviously the product of economic interest. They sought to replace suburbia by providing new settlements that didn't rely on providing commuters. London was to be contained with the Green Belt so that the town did not leap forward, for example, from Edgware to Elstree. The new towns made possible by the New Towns Act of 1946 and the Town and Country Planning Act of 1947 were to be built beyond this green belt. The first, Stevenage, was chosen in 1946. V.F. Soothill, the medical officer for Norwich, wrote in 1935 that the spread of suburbia was, quote, a quiet social revolution. But by the late 40s, a different social revolution was at hand, one that looked towards greater state control and was in accordance with the more general social norms being pushed in that period, the policy prescriptions and cultural and intellectual emphases of the Labour governments. Already, the Housing Town Planning Act of 1909 had been the first piece of legislation to use the term town planning. John Burns, the president of the local government board, a radical liberal, introduced the legislation in 1908 by telling Parliament that it set out, quote, to provide a domestic condition for the people in which their physical health, their morals, their character, and their whole social condition can be improved, to secure the home healthy. The results, however, were to be mixed, as the reforms of the late 1940s were to show. And next time, I want to begin our consideration of the second half of the 20th century, and by kicking off with the 1950s. Graham, I wonder if there are any particular points that you might have.
Well, there certainly are, Jeremy, and thank you very much indeed. One of the themes, particularly in discussing the consequences of wartime bombing, the subsequent clearance and rebuilding, is to what extent the war created an opportunity for rebuilding cities, but to what extent the theory behind it was already in place. I mean, you mentioned slum clearance the first levels of town and country planning legislation before that as well. Was there something peculiar about the kind of building a brave new world in the war years that led to a different interpretation of what urban planning should look like and with the consequences we have compared to the thinking in the interwar period of the 1920s and 1930s?
Well, yes. I mean, some of those ideas had been present earlier. As I mentioned, there had been ideas of urban reconstruction. And in a way, much of it was, you could argue, latent with the development of the big council house estates, which I mentioned last time, places like Walthamstow and Speke, or around Hornchurch. But I think the idea of a and of course there was also, as you will know, the you know, sort of Victorian buildings were being knocked down in the interwar years in places where there was economic interest in doing so. So, for example, in the city of London. But I think the whole scale was very, very different. And of course you get different groups come to the fore in particular contexts. So it's worth considering, for example, if the COVID pandemic of 2020, this is Blue Sky's thought, if the COVID pandemic of 2020 to 2022 had come to the fore when the Prime Minister of the country was Mr. Corbyn and there was a radical Labour government, it would possibly have been used, in my view, very probably used, to push through all sorts of policies under the name of national need and emergency. And of course, helped by the fact that Parliament wouldn't have been in sitting in, you know, because of the COVID regulations there. And I think it's fair to say that the national emergencies of war tend to lead to ideas which in peacetime people often would not entertain. So, and this is not only from the left. If you're thinking about 1797 to 1801, as I'm sure all listeners are, you'll be aware that the Pitt, the younger administration, pushed through, introduced things like First National Census, pushed forward the mapping of the country by the Ordnance Survey, parliamentary union with Ireland, combination acts to limit trade union disputes, etc., etc. World War One sees all sorts of differences. World War Two does. I mean, you take Britain today. Were there to be large-scale terrorist atrocities, it is possible that that might lead to the introduction of things. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I'm just simply commenting how change is often a matter of context. For example, to identity cards. I don't know. But the point is that what often happens is ideas that exist already are pushed through in a different context.
Mm-hmm. It seems so. I just one more question, if I may. Going back to what you were saying earlier about the rollout of the national grid and just the ability of the utilities to reach more homes. By the mid to late 1930s, most homes are still primarily powered by, or still primarily heated by coal, so the coal fires and the water being heated by coal, or what proportion of homes would be seeing using electricity and gas?
Well, electricity was produced, I mean, town gas was, you know, produced, which is what it was. It's not North Sea gas, you know. I mean, there's a difference between the route. And electricity, of course, was obtained by the use of coal. There's a difference between the root energy source and the means of, as it were, usage. So you can still be using coal, even if you haven't got coal in a coal bunker outside. What I would say is that in urban areas, coal is principally used through in new homes, through the electricity and gas system. Whereas in old homes, there's a continued reliance on the bunker. And as you probably know, I mean, the house I live in, which is an older home, although it's now blocked up, it wasn't blocked up when I bought the house in 1996. There was still a chute which went into the basement. And the point about that chute was that the coal man could put the coal down the chute without having to come into the house. And again, that was a reason why you often have these side passages to houses, again, to take coal to coal sheds. And again, the same. I mean, you look at look around Exeter, look around Ulmer Road, for example, the name itself, or Roberts Road, the names themselves, reminiscent of Victorian victories. These still have, although they're not used anymore, but they would have been used till the 60s. They had sort of lanes that ran along the back of properties, narrow lanes, where the coal was moved in that way. So it's more a question of the age of the property. And incidentally, if you're looking at energy change today, and as you know, we have a very vigorous heating revolution being proposed by Mr. Miliband. One of the great faults it has is it fails to take existing note of the character and range of the existing housing stock, and in particular, how you would be able to introduce those means to all old properties, and for that matter, to all rural properties. And again, one of the difficulties with regulation, you'll get the same thing with, of course, regulation vis-a-vis electric cars as opposed to other systems, is that the difficulty is if you make it compulsory, you in effect create a social criminals, people that can't, or their properties can't be converted readily in that fashion.
Yes, well, I figure something like a quarter of homes in England were built before the First World War and are not at all easily adapted. But it would be nice to think the government has thought of that, but it
No,
doesn't
I mean,
seem.
I think, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I look, there have been faults and flaws in many governments, and people will have their own views of some of the ministers of the Crown in recent years. That goes without saying. I think a fair assessment of the new government would be that it's propounded itself as a very different character to its predecessor and predecessors. And in terms of issues such as probity, the corruption of convenience and connections and competence, it does not at the present moment do very well in comparison. And I'm afraid Mr. Miliband, his conduct can only lead, and his sort of euphoric ideas about it that are completely impractical can only lead people to think that in 2015, whatever the deficiencies, undoubted deficiencies of David Cameron, at least the electorate didn't turn to Miliband at that time.
Well, we shall leave it on that topical observation. Next time, we will pick up with the history of English towns from the 1950s onwards. But Jeremy Black, for talking us through the interwar and war years, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.